Bibles with me, if you will, to Mark chapter 1. We read chapter 14, but we're going to begin in chapter 1. And you may be wondering what's next since we finished Galatians last week. Well, let me tell you what's next. Summer preaching schedule will look something like this. For the next 5 weeks, we're going to look at the prayers of Jesus. You remember we had a 10-week series on the parables and miracles of Jesus, but we never talked about the prayers of Jesus, and so we're going to do that for the next 5 weeks. After that, Lori and I will be gone for a couple weeks. We have a family reunion in Texas with my siblings. It'll be our first one since our mom passed. And so we'll be spending a few days there, and then we'll be celebrating our 40th anniversary somewhere along the way. And it's hard to believe 40, we're so young. Probably somewhere in between here in Texas, Louisiana, maybe. I'm not sure exactly sure where, but we'll stop for dinner somewhere for our 40th anniversary along the way. And during that time, Josh will be preaching a three-week series. We're thinking right now it's going to be a Jesus in the Old Testament. He will pick three passages from the Old Testament and that are directly related to Jesus and bring that out. That should be very good. And then after that, about 90%, 85 to 90% certain, that we will begin a series on the book of Joshua. We have not been in the Old Testament for a while, and we don't spend a lot of time in that book, Joshua, Judges, Ruth. We know a lot about the first five books of creation and the flood and Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, and the Exodus. But we really don't get into going into the promised land very often. But in Joshua draws us a picture of God's faithfulness, and he tells the people to remember God's faithfulness and to live in unity. And we see that in the book of Joshua, and I think it would be good for us to remember those things as we look forward to moving into a new phase of the ministry in Providence Church with a new building that may be our own someday. We need to remember God's faithfulness to us now, and that we need to live in unity and love, because that's how others will know that we are Christ followers, because of the way that we love. And so that will be what we're going to do. That will take us into mid-July when we'll begin the book of Joshua. So keep those things in mind, if you will, and in your prayers, that we'll be looking at the book of Joshua, and before that, we'll be listening to the preaching of Joshua, our Joshua, Josh, and in the next 5 weeks, we'll be looking at the prayers of Jesus. Augustine said it this way. He said, what can be more excellent than prayer? What is more profitable to our life? What sweeter to our souls? What more sublime in the course of our whole life than the practice of prayer? Martin Luther said this, to be a Christian without prayer is no more possible than to be alive without breathing. Charles Spurgeon said, true prayer is neither a mere mental exercise nor a vocal performance. It is far deeper than that. It is a spiritual transaction with the Creator of heaven and earth. And I would argue that a vibrant prayer life is one of the most desired things of a follower of Christ. But it is often one of the greatest disappointments, isn't it? Prayer is hard. Sometimes when we hear people pray, we we think, you know, if they spoke to their friends like that, their friends would lose their minds. Sometimes we think we don't pray because we can't express it as well as other people express it, and we don't get all the phrases right, and we don't have all the formulas for prayer, and you know, sometimes we get involved in what could be meaningless repetition that we would not say if we're talking to a friend. We can't quite get the pious tones of our voice into a prayer voice. And so we think we're not praying well. And we think, well, if we can't get the language right, how do we do it? Sometimes we speak with God and it's the other extreme, isn't it? It's like we're speaking to Santa Claus. Like God is there to meet our needs. This is what I want. And he's the, remember years ago, there was a Shell station, the Shell answer man. He is our answer man. And prayer becomes a form of a rabbit's foot for us, where it gives us all the good things that we wish for. Or perhaps you're one of those that you just feel guilty because your prayer doesn't seem to measure up to the standards of what prayer should be. So we don't pray in a group, and we don't even pray sometimes privately because we don't know the proper etiquette of prayer. How do we do this? So how, if all those things affect us, how do we create a life of prayer? A life where you go easily to God at any moment, at any time, no matter where you are, and you know that he hears you. So my prayer over these next 5 weeks is that we will see some principles in the prayers of Jesus that will help us to cultivate that kind of a prayer life, where we can go to God at any time, and we go to God at special times, and prayer becomes natural for us, and prayer becomes a constant happening in our lives, and prayer is just like air to us, as Martin Luther said. So we come to Mark this morning, and we think of that old hymn. You know, what a friend we have in Jesus, all our sins and griefs to bear. What a privilege to carry everything to God in prayer. And we say, well, it is a privilege to carry everything to God in prayer. And we should pray, and we should have continual communion with God, and we should have special times of prayer, and prayer should be a normal part of our lives. And this morning, we're going to look at just three examples of Jesus' prayer this morning in Mark, that Mark portrays for us three examples of Jesus that show that it takes a lifestyle of prayer. It takes a lifestyle of prayer to stay focused in the good times. And it takes a lifestyle of prayer to stand firm in the difficult times. And it takes a lifestyle of prayer to submit humbly to the will of God at all times. We need to be people of prayer. So we're going to look at those three things. First of all, a lifestyle of prayer that helps you to stay focused in the good times. We're going to look at chapter 1, verses 35 through 39, and we'll read those in just a moment. But question that comes to mind is, when we think of Jesus, if Jesus is the Son of God, why did he need to pray? Wasn't he in constant communion with God? Wasn't he always talking to the Father? Why did he need a specific time to pray? Didn't he have a hotline to heaven? We read in chapter 1, verses 35 through 39, these words. And rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. And Simon and those who were with him searched for him. And they found him and said to him, "Everyone is looking for you." And he said to them, "Let us go on to the next towns that I may preach there also, for that is why I came." And he went throughout all Galilee, preaching in their synagogue and casting out demons. Why did Jesus feel the need to go away and pray? It seems that he needed time to talk with the Father. Perhaps he had a hard time shutting out the world just like we do. Now, what is the context of this prayer? Well, in chapter 1, verses 1, or verses 21 through 39, we see what is going on here. They're in Capernaum. They're on the Sabbath day. He was teaching in the synagogue. They were all astonished. Jesus is beginning his ministry. This is actually the first day of his ministry. He preached and he prayed all over Israel. He begins in Capernaum, which is around the Sea of Galilee. If you remember, Israel is that very thin strip of land. In the north, there's the Sea of Galilee, and the Jordan River runs down from that into the south to the Dead Sea. He's up north. He's in Capernaum. He's in the northern part where he began his ministry. We're going to see in chapter 9 that he goes even further north in the Transfiguration, and he's praying in the Transfiguration, and he's healing demons 25 miles north, which is today on the Lebanon and Syria border, which is as far as you can go and still be in any part of Israel. And the south slope is the Golan Heights. I didn't know this until a few years ago, but when Donald Trump was president, they named a town on the Golan Heights for him. That he had a very good relationship. Apparently, it's called Trump Heights. I think that's just crazy myself to have that in the Holy Land, but it is there. But Jesus prays there. And then he will see in chapter 14, he goes all the way down to Jerusalem where he is crucified, and he prays there. He had a lifestyle of prayer. He's an example of what it means to have a life of prayer. And so the first day of his ministry, he in verses 21 through 28, he's teaching in the synagogues in Capernaum, and the crowd is amazed at his teaching. And a demon-possessed man cries out to him. He says, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? I know who you are, the Holy One of God," in verse 24. He cries out to Jesus. And what does Jesus then do? Jesus simply says, "Be silent and come out of him." Very simply, no drama, just simply says, "Be silent and come out of him." And it says, and the spirit came out convulsing and crying. There was the drama. And they were all amazed. They were all amazed that he did this. And they all got out their cell phones. In verse 28, it says, and at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the region. This is a Sabbath. Now, obviously, they didn't have cell phones. But on the Sabbath, you can only go a Sabbath journey, about 3/4 of a mile. You can't go any further than that. So how did it spread? Did they go as far as they could and then others took it and it spread throughout the whole region? The news of this spread throughout the region. Everyone was talking about this. And what did Jesus do? Verse 29, he immediately left the synagogue and entered the house of Simon and Andrew. He went to lunch. Now Simon's mother-in-law lay ill with a fever. And immediately they told him about her, and he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and the fever went away, and she began to serve them. Jesus goes from there, as the word spreads about him, he goes to lunch. Now remember, this is a Sabbath. No one shows up until 6 p.m. It's going to say that that evening is sundown. At sundown, they brought him all the sick and oppressed by the demons. They were bringing everybody. Word is spreading. Jesus is enjoying his lunch, waiting for the end of Sabbath, which went from 6 to 6, 6 p.m., the end of Sabbath. So they couldn't bring anyone until Sabbath ended. So you can imagine they've got their sick by the door. Or they've gone their 3/4 of a mile, which is all they can walk, and they got to wait till 6 o'clock. And then they all show up at Peter's home. They all come. They have their torches, and it's getting dark, and the crowd is gathering. The whole city gathered at the door, and Jesus heals the entire night. He is healing people the entire night. And Luke tells us this is why he came. He came to preach good news and to give sight to the blind. And this is why he came, and he is doing what he came to do. And the first mention of Jesus praying then happens immediately after that in verses 35 through 39. We're told the next morning, before sunrise, Jesus wakes up and he goes out of town to a desolate place. That word can be translated wilderness. So he went someplace out of town. Wilderness there is a desert. Jesus seemed to love the wilderness as a place to pray. Luke 5:16 says Jesus often withdrew to lonely places to pray. Why did he go there? The disciples obviously did not understand Jesus' need to pray. In verse 36 of chapter 1, and Simon Peter and those who are with him says, "Search for him," and they found him. They said, "Everyone's looking for you." The word "search for him" there simply means they hunted him down. They couldn't find him, and they went to hunt him down because the crowd's gathering. This is big ministry. This is ministry opportunity. And it says they hunted him down. It gives the idea of an unwanted intrusion into his prayer time, that he was praying and they hunt him down. Everyone is looking for you. What did they want? They wanted to control Jesus' agenda. Come on, you know, this is what you came for. Yesterday was great, but look at all this, all that we can do today. Let's go back and do this. But we're told that Jesus left in order to pray. Mark suggests this is an important point in his ministry, and Jesus seeks guidance from the Father. And in the middle of this spiritual victory, of all these people being healed, Jesus prays. Why? To keep himself focused on the mission. What does verse 38 say? Verse 38, and he said to them, not let's go back and keep enjoying what's happened last night, but let us go on to the next towns that I may preach there also, for that is why I came out. Jesus withdrew from this really good ministry that's going on, prayed to the Father. Instead of just staying there and soaking it all in, he says, I have a focus. I have a purpose. Let's go to the other towns. He didn't go back. He went forward. It seems like seclusion and power are somehow linked in Jesus' life. He goes into seclusion and prays, and then there's a power to heal and to preach and to save. And right now, things are going well, and when things are going well, Jesus prays. What are the implications for us in this simple example? I think a number of things that we as a church, Providence Church, needs to be a church that is in prayer for the future of the ministry in Lehigh Acres. We need to pray in the good times, and these are great times. We have seen growth, and we have seen some baptisms, and we've seen people come into the church, and we need to pray in these good times. Why? To stay focused on what the ministry is. You know, Jesus said, I can do nothing without the Father. read a couple of verses for you in John chapter 5, verse 19. Jesus says this, so Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. Verse 30 of that same chapter, I can do nothing of my own. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just because I seek not my own, but my own will, but the will of him who sent me. Chapter 8 of John, verse 28. Verse 28 says this, so Jesus said to them, when you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am he, and that I do nothing of my own authority, but seek just as the Father taught me. Chapter 12, verse 49 of John, verse 49. For I have not spoken of my own authority, but the Father who sent me has himself given me a commandment, what to say and what to speak. And I know that his commandment is eternal life. And I say, therefore, I say as the Father has told me. Jesus is saying, I can do nothing without the Father. And we can do nothing without the Father. And if we believe that as Jesus believed it, then the only thing that makes sense is that we become people of prayer. When we were in our last years with the mission that we served with, I served as a regional director for Europe, and once a year, all of the directors would get together for about 10 days, and we'd talk about business and all the things of the mission. But in the middle of that time, there would be one day that was set aside called a day of prayer. Imagine that, a day of prayer, because we were to pray that day. And it was a day where you could come alone by yourself, whatever you wanted to do with your Bible, spend the whole day, walk in the park, drink coffee, and spend the day in prayer. And then we would come back at the end of the day and we would celebrate. What was your day in prayer like? And that was the key point, the key moment of that entire 10 days. We talked about business for 9 days, but we spent one full day in prayer. Why? Because we can do nothing without God. And so we need to be a church of prayer. If we do not pray, what are we saying? We're saying quietly, but we're saying it. We're saying that time and money and talent are all we need in this life and in this church. And we never have enough of any of them. If we just have enough time to make enough money and enough talent to make that money, we can do it. And when we don't have enough of those, and we don't pray, and we don't have those things, we're saying, I don't have enough time to make room for prayer. Or I need to do more to make money, and I don't have time to pray. And I don't have time because I don't have enough time, money, or talent. And it's a vicious circle because we never have enough money, time, or talent, so we never pray. And Jesus has given us an example that we need to take specific time to pray. Jesus made a priority to pray in the good times, so that he remained focused on the purposes for which God sent him to earth. Secondly, a lifestyle of prayer helps you stand firm in the difficult times. Mark chapter 9. Mark chapter 9. We'll not read all this, but from verses 9 through 29, it's the story of the transfiguration on the top of the mountain. Peter, James, and John are there, and you know this story. The big three, the ones who seem to be closest to Jesus, are there with him. And in chapter 9, verse 2, we'll read verses 2 through 8. On the sixth day, Jesus took Peter, James, and John to a high mountain by themselves. A lot of people think that's Mount Hermon, which is in the far north. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared before him Elijah and Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah." That's a comical statement. We'll talk about that in a minute. For he did not know what to say, for they were terrified, and a cloud overshadowed them. Voice came out of the cloud, "This is my beloved son, listen to him." And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. That is the context of what is happening here. Jesus changes, and the disciples are shocked, and they hear the voice of God, and I would be shocked too. Luke tells us that when this was happening, Jesus prayed, and then his countenance changed. The disciples didn't understand any of this. They were in shock, and that's why it's a bit comical when Peter says, you know, there's Jesus and Moses and Elijah. And what does he say? You know, why don't we set up a tent for you guys? He didn't know what to say. He was just so in shock. As a matter of fact, he tells us he did not know what to say. And they did not know how to react, because what happened when they came down in verse 14? And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them, the scribes arguing with them, and immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him. I wonder why they were amazed at Jesus. It's probably because, remember, when Moses went up on the mountain and he came down and the glory of God was around him, it was probably the same in Jesus' face glowing here, and they were amazed at him. But what did the disciples do? Well, the disciples who were down below were arguing. They were arguing with the scribes, and these disciples come down, and what did they do? They didn't say, you know, we have just had a mountaintop experience, but they went right back to what was happening before. But what does Jesus do after that? He heals a boy who is mute and deaf. And when he came to the disciples, they saw a crowd, they were greatly amazed. And then the people said in verse 18, and talking about the demon, and whenever it sees him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they couldn't do it. Now, Jesus had given authority to the disciples in chapter 6 to cast out demons, but they could not cast this one out. And so what did the disciples do after they got alone with Jesus? Before that, in verse 22, he's often cast into fire and into water and destroys, but if you, Jesus, can do anything, have compassion. And Jesus cast him out. And the disciples then said, why could we not cast this demon out? And Jesus said, evil like this requires prayer. Verse 29, and he said to them, this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. Now, what do we notice? Jesus didn't pray. Jesus didn't pray before he cast out this demon. So what does he mean? This kind cannot be cast out without prayer. There was no special prayer the disciples needed to say, you know, come out in the name of Jesus, come out. There was no special words that they needed to say or pray. Jesus is talking about a lifetime of prayer. He's talking about a lifestyle of prayer. He's talking about being prayed up so that when this kind of evil comes, you're ready for it. When the difficult time comes, you're ready for this. Jesus has showed the disciples a lifetime of prayer, but they did not understand Jesus' need to pray. The disciples failed to cast out the demon. And Jesus is saying that is the importance of a lifestyle of prayer. This one is cast out only by prayer. And I didn't pray just before I cast him out, but I have been praying with the Father all along. I have had time on the Mount of Transfiguration. I have time in the desert. I have a time alone. We need to be those kinds of prayers. Because when we don't, we risk two things. We risk losing our focus on the work that God has set before us in the good times. And we risk being swept away by all of the rough seas in the difficult times. C.S. Lewis said this way, "I especially need your prayers because I am, like the pilgrim in Bunyan, Pilgrim's Progress, traveling across a plain called ease. Anything, everything without and many things within are marvelously well." And so I need your prayer. And our thought is, no, you need our prayer when you're in trouble. You need our prayer when it's difficult. And Jesus says, you need to pray now so that you are ready to go through those difficult times. And we all go through those difficult times, whether it's an illness or whether it's financial difficulties or whether it's a loss of a loved one. We need to be people of prayer so that when the difficult times come, we're able to stand in those times and not be swept away by the wind and the waves of that storm. And then finally, a lifestyle of prayer helps one submit humbly to the will of God at all times. This is in chapter 14, and these are the verses that we read this morning. Chapter 14, verses 32 through 42. This is a story of intense prayer, story of intense distress, intense agony. Jesus had already had a full evening. He had been teaching the disciples. He had been talking about what is important. He had humbly washed their feet, which is unheard of in that culture, that a teacher would wash his students' feet. He had instituted the Lord's Prayer. He was in the process of being betrayed by one of the closest people to him. He has with him Peter, who will betray him three times this night. He has with him James and John, who were, we could call the power brokers. They were wondering who's going to be on the right and who's going to be on the left when the kingdom comes. Who's going to be there? Who's going to be your right-hand man? And he tells them, watch and pray. Those who did not get his need to pray, he says, watch and pray. And Jesus is in distress here in verses 34 and 35. And he said to them, my soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch. And going a little further, he fell on the ground and prayed. What kind of agony was this? Well, Psalm 55 gives us an idea of what Jesus was feeling. In Psalm 55, beginning in verse 4, the psalmist writes this, my heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death have fallen upon me. Fear and trembling come upon me, and horror overwhelms me. And I say, oh, that I had wings like a dove, I would fly away and be at rest. Yes, I would fly wander far away. I would wander far away. I would lodge in the wilderness. I would hurry to find a shelter from the raging wind and tempest. Ever feel like that? We've all felt like that at some point. And Jesus faces the most difficult hour and prays the most important prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. Why is this most important prayer? Because if this prayer fails, if the Father does not answer this prayer, then God's grace and God's salvation in the world fail. Everything that Jesus came to do, fails, if this prayer is not answered. And in anguish, Jesus waited. Now, waiting is a hard thing. It's like waiting to hear back from the doctor, waiting for the test to come. It's a difficult thing to wait. Jesus was waiting, being abandoned by the Father. But Jesus was able to stand up and face death through prayer. For Jesus, prayer was not a way to avoid the difficulty, but prayer was a way through the difficulty. How did he do it? I think Hebrews 5:7 gives us the key with that. Hebrews 5:7 says this: in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverence. He was heard because of his reverence. He had a relationship with the Father. He spoke often with the Father. What is reverence? Reverence is simply a recognition of God's holiness. And the result of a recognition of God's holiness is submissive obedience. Well, how do we get there? Jesus would say, by a lifestyle of prayer, by a lifetime of prayer. His prayer was answered. You think, well, how was his prayer answered? He was still crucified. He prayed this: if possible, let this cup pass from me, but your will be done. You see, the cup was not removed from Jesus. Luke chapter 22, verse 41. We see another part of that prayer in Gethsemane. Verse 41 of Luke chapter 22 says this: and he withdrew from them about a stone's throw and knelt down and prayed, saying, Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And there appeared to him an angel from heaven, strengthening him. An angel ministered to him. He prayed and he trusted in reverence. He knew for sure that the promises of God would come true. He knew Isaiah 53. He knew Isaiah 53 that we read this morning, but he knew verses 10 through 11 would come through, where it says, yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The Lord, the will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. He knew that would come true. Whatever God decided, that would come true. Whatever the Father determined, that would come true. His prayer was not for the cup to pass, but he prayed for the success of drinking it. He prayed not that he wouldn't have to drink it, but that he would have the courage and the strength and the boldness to drink it. That's why Hebrews 12:2 says, for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. He knew what was coming. He knew he would be with the Father. He knew all of these people throughout history would be saved because of this event. And in the middle of the agony was the assurance of future joy. A lifetime of prayer in the believer, a lifetime of reverence and trust and humble submission of God's will comes through a lifetime of prayer. No matter the immediate agony. So the question is, are we investing enough time in prayer now so that when the difficult times come, we'll not be overtaken by anxiety, but we will be connected to God saying, I don't like this, but I know your promises are true. Through prayer, we're connected to God and he gives us the strength to endure. Lifestyle prayer helps us to stay focused in the good times, helps us to stand firm in the difficult times, and it helps us to submit obediently at all times. You know, we learn lessons not only from the success of Jesus in this, but from the failures of the disciples. They couldn't cast out the demon. Why? Was it wrong technique? No. Did they have the authority? Yes. Jesus gave them the authority in Mark 6:7. But I think gifts are renewed daily. Power is given daily. Power to endure this life is given daily. And they thought the gift was under their control. They thought, we can do this. He's given us the authority. We can do this. And so they never understood the importance of prayer. And in prayer, we look to God for his power and his supply, not to ourselves, that, God, I need this today. I need your power today. I need to stand against temptation today. Their second failure was at Gethsemane. Jesus prayed intently, an intense prayer. They slept 3 times. When they did not pray, Jesus was betrayed. Temple guards arrested Jesus. Peter does not pray and denies Jesus 3 times that night. All the disciples abandoned Jesus. They all flipped. They did not pray. Corrie ten Boom, who many of you know, helped hide Jews during World War II in her home. She said this, or asked this question, is prayer your steering wheel or your spare tire? Is prayer your steering wheel or your spare tire? Does it direct your life? Is it taking you where you need to go? Or do you pull it out only when you have a spare tire or when you have a flat? That will determine whether you stay focused at good times, stand firm in difficult times, submit at all times. Is if prayer is your driver or steering wheel or your spare tire. R.A. Torrey, who was a great evangelist at the end of 19th century, beginning of 20th century, became pastor of Moody Church in Chicago. He said this, and we close. And I think this is application for us. When the devil sees a man or woman who really believes in prayer, who knows how to pray, and who really does pray, and above all, when he sees a whole church on its face before God in prayer, he trembles as much as he ever did, for he knows that his day in that church or in that community is at an end. May Providence Church be characterized by that kind of prayer. Prayer that causes Satan to tremble because he knows his day is at an end. Let's pray together.